this exact moment.
Groceries in San Francisco.
Hello?
Here's the problem.
Well, I would have no way of knowing, so I'll assume that I am not talking to the country, since I still hear the tape in the background. Well, it appears that I'm actually on the radio. And John Lott, are you actually there? Well, I'm glad to know I'm on, and that's why I said, John Lott, are you still there? Our guest, who was originally scheduled for this portion of the program, who was wondering what the sounds were that he was hearing being sent down the line, suffice it to say, John, that we had some technical difficulties, but it would be very nice if, in fact, our guest was on hand. Otherwise, we might as well go back to talking about the post office, wouldn't you say, boys and girls? So rather than putting me on the air, it would be better to find out, I think, first, if, in fact, our guest was still hanging in.
I am here.
Oh, you are. And I'm here, and I guess the whole country is listening in. At least I assume that you and I are not talking to each other at this particular juncture. Ladies and gentlemen, we're
to you anyway. But,
yes, it's a pleasure to talk to you, John. And suffice it to say, folks, we hope you enjoyed our little primer on the U.S. Post Office from a previous program, and we had a number of things to talk about with John in this portion of the program. So let's do so. First of all, for those who don't know, John Lott is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, and their website is crimeresearch.org. He is an economist and author, and you can find him on Twitter at John R. Lott Jr., JohnRLottJr. And we're here tonight to talk about a variety of things. And I wanted to talk, first of all, about the Supreme Court that, of course, will get up to full membership, providing the Senate goes ahead and confirms Neil Gorsuch. We now know for a fact that the Gorsuch hearings will begin on Monday, March the 20th, before the Senate Judiciary Committee. There will be a day of opening statements, and then the questioning of Judge Neil Gorsuch will begin on Tuesday, March 21st, and probably go most of the week. And, John, you've written an interesting article on, well, as you start off in the article, a simple rule of thumb. What is that rule of thumb about Supreme Court nominees?
Well, the smarter they are, the harder the confirmation battle that they're going to face. I suppose the easiest way to think about this is to think about juries. My guess is, I don't know if you've ever been on a jury, but
it's very
likely that you would be on compared to other people for a simple reason, and that is you're a smart, very articulate guy. And so if any of the lawyers on either side of a case thought that you might be leaning ever so slightly against them, they would strike you from the jury pool because you're more than one vote. You could pull four or five other members of the jury with you. They would much rather use one of their few strikes that they have to remove you than, let's say, somebody who they're more certain is against them but is not as articulate or as bright. And the same thing is true when you're talking about Supreme Court justices. That, you know, there's not a huge difference usually across the types of people Republicans will be putting up for the court. The main difference is in terms of the impact they're going to have not only on maybe swaying other votes on the Supreme Court, but writing opinions that are going to influence other judges around the country. I'll give you a simple example. If you look at citations to judges' opinions from other judges, probably the simplest measure of their impact on other judges' thinking. For each 20% more citations that judge gets to their decisions, if you look back to see how difficult their confirmation process was, it would take about 60% longer for them to get through the confirmation process. Senators are very good at figuring out which judges are going to be the most influential, and those are the ones they fight hardest against trying to make sure they're not going to get on the court.
That's rather self-defeating. I appreciate your kind words. I have served on two juries. I was the foreman of one, and an interesting experience to say the least. And I certainly noted that, yes, in terms of those juries, I probably did have a disproportionate voice, and that certainly others did as well. Obviously, the jury pool may have had one vote per person, but clearly the influence of people was not one vote per person. Now, in regards to Supreme Court nominees, it would seem, therefore, this sounds rather dumb, but it may well be the case. Stranger things have been the truth, that it would behoove any president, liberal or conservative, to pick somebody not quite so Borkish, if you will, referring right. to the almost justice Robert Bork, who probably fit this definition rather well.
Right. Well, let me give you an example on the other side, just to illustrate, just to contrast it. When in 2005, when I'm just drawing a blank on the woman that was put up by George Bush. The opposition, Harriet Myers, the opposition to her came from the Republicans. We knew she was strongly against abortion, and Democrats in many court appointments will go to the barricades if they say somebody is strongly against abortion. That will be the single reason enough for them to claim that they're against a nominee. But if you go back, you'll find everybody from Harriet Reid to Chuck Schumer and other Democrats spoke very highly of Harriet Myers, saying that they thought that she'd be a wonderful addition to the Supreme Court, despite her strong opposition to abortion. And the opposition to her came from Republicans. Republican senators would leak word to reporters saying that they were going to be asking questions, basic law school-type questions to her when she came up for the hearing, as a way of embarrassing her and hopefully convincing her to drop out, which she eventually did. The reason why the Republicans were against her wasn't that they didn't think that they agreed with her. They believed that they did. The reason was is they just didn't think that she was that bright and that she could be taken advantage of by other members of the Supreme Court and that she wouldn't have the type of influence that they would like to have, you know, in dramatic contrast to somebody like Bork, who probably would have been one of the more brilliant people that could have been put on the Supreme Court.
Have you noticed any indication that this lesson has been learned by presidents in recent years? Let's just say post-Robert Bork, who, of course, another thing that Robert Bork had was a lengthy paper trail, which dogged him the entire way. But I'm wondering if other presidents have learned this. We need to pick somebody who's not really, really bright. I mean, at least not someone who looks like they're going to rewrite the history books. And somebody who doesn't have much of a paper trail. I mean, if you just want confirmation, there are some clear lessons that have been learned in the past, say, quarter century or so of Supreme Court confirmation hearings.
Right. Well, you know, just to, on the first part that you're bringing up about a lengthy paper trail, you know, you can look at that across different Supreme Court nominations or nominations to the appeals court. You know, it's possible to go back and look at how much they published in different types of areas. And, you know, publications have some impact on the confirmation process, but the big thing is how bright these guys are. You know, there's another way of measuring this, and that is, like, where did they go to law school? How well did they do in law school? So if you look at people who went to a top 10 law school, were in the top 10% of their class,
okay.
An appeals court nomination and a Supreme – or appeals court –
All right. Well, now we're coming up on a break that doesn't move here, so I want to come back and pick up that notion of figuring out the confirmation of these nominees. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. We're talking with John Lott. He is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, online at crimeresearch.org. He is an economist and author. We often speak with him about various issues on gun control, and there is one that I would like to bring up before this hour is up. But right now we're talking about picking confirmable, if you will, Supreme Court nominees. Now that we know that the Neil Gorsuch nomination hits the Senate Judiciary Committee March 20th, Monday, that week will be devoted to what the committee has to say. I guess before we go back to our original train of thought, John, it would appear that we're probably at this juncture talking about another party line vote here.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty clear. How how much they're going to fight, I think, depends upon whether they think there'll be a second nomination this year. If Democrats believe by March, the end of March, that Gorsuch is going to be the only case that they're going to be facing this year for the Supreme Court, I think it's going to be a major battle. If they think that a second person's coming up, they'll hold some of their fire.
All right. That begs a follow-up, and then we'll get back to the point you were making at the break. There have been rumors, obviously every liberal on the court, read that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, will be hanging on by her fingernails no matter how she feels, and we understand that. But I've heard rumors that Anthony Kennedy, who is, I think, maybe 80, the swing vote, but originally put up for the court as a conservative, that he might think about retiring with a Republican president to pick his successor. Have you heard much more about that?
Well, only what I've read in the paper.
Exactly. That's all I've heard. So.
And, I mean, if he is going to retire and he wants to make it relatively easy for the president to replace somebody, you got a Republican Senate right now. My guess is when you have the election next year for the Senate, given how many more Democratic seats are up than Republican seats, it seems pretty sure that the Republicans will keep control of the Senate for at least 4 years now. But he doesn't want to do it in an election year like next year. So it would either be now or 2 years from now.
Okay, very good. Now then, back to what you were talking about as the break came along, and that had to do with looking at confirmable nominees. And you were going so far as to go back to looking at how people did in law school or did on their law boards or did on the bar exam or the LSAT or what have you. What exactly do you look at, and what do you look for if, in fact, confirmation of a nominee is your goal?
Right. Well, I mean, just to answer your overall question first, and that is, I think presidents have shied away from putting the very brightest people on the courts, the Supreme Court and the appeals court. The one change has occurred over the last few years during the Obama administration, when they had the nuclear option, where they no longer had to worry about a potential filibuster for nominees that would be put up. If you look over the previous 50 years, how smart justices were on the Supreme Court or appeals court justices were basically declining over time. If you looked at the impact that justices had, you know, you didn't get somebody who would have as many citations to their opinions, who would be as influential as you used to have, except for the last few years with Obama. So his impact, President Obama's impact on the courts, was much larger than just the number of people he put on the court, so he put on a lot. And my guess is that trend is basically going to continue under Trump, because the nuclear option has still been triggered once the Democrats did it, at least for appeals court and district court judges. Whether they're going to do that for the Supreme Court, I think it's likely changed there too, because the threat of triggering it for this Supreme Court is something that's been made pretty explicit. So even though they still have the potential right now under Senate rules to filibuster a Supreme Court nomination, we know that that rule can be removed and will likely be removed if a filibuster were to occur. So I think Gorsuch is part of a trend that you're going to see under Trump for any other vacancies, and that is he's going to take advantage of the change rules that the Democrats have, and he too is going to nominate brighter people that will be more influential than we've seen in other recent years.
All right. About this nuclear option, it seems that any time you have a party with a slim majority in the Senate, and in terms of the 60-vote rule, that would be most of the time. It isn't that often, I don't think, that any one party controls 60 votes in the Senate. So, therefore, it would seem that the vast majority of the time it would behoove the slim majority party to invoke the nuclear option. Because otherwise the other side can block them. And as long as you have that option, why would you not just go ahead? I mean, I don't even understand why, for all intents and purposes, the filibuster hasn't disappeared.
Right. Well, I mean, the point of having the filibuster was in some sense to force compromise, to force people to go and nominate people who would kind of be a little bit more moderate or less threatening to the other side. But as you say, at this point, you know, that's kind of gone by the boards. And so Democrats are, you know, ruining the day that they change the rules in the Senate. And the Republicans are going to take advantage of it, just as the Democrats have over the last few years.
Yeah. Still, so, it may be interesting that they may rue the day, but I mean, this could have happened any time. And again, it would just strike me that if you are the leader of a slim majority and you want to have your way, and this is a perfectly legal option, it just makes no sense to me that anybody would not invoke this rule the vast majority of the time.
Well, the reason why they didn't invoke it before is that people generally realize that even though you are in the majority now, you'll likely be in the minority at some point in the future, as the Democrats have learned. And so the rules in the Senate were there to protect the minority in the Senate.
Yeah, but there's nothing inviolate about the rules, since any party in the majority can change them.
Well, they didn't know really that they could change them, or at least they hadn't figured it out that they could change them in the way that Harry Reid did. What Harry Reid did was essentially tell the Senate parliamentarian, the guy who interprets what the rules are, not to answer the question on what the rules are when the Republicans asked. And so what they did was more ignore the rules, find out a way of how just to ignore the rules than to change them.
But by any other definition, obviously it's an option. And again,
right,
from this point on, it's hard for me to imagine why anybody would ever go back to the old way. I guess you can thank Harry Reid or blame him, be that as it may, but I would think that probably thank him would be the case for both parties. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, as we talk about this situation with the Supreme Court. And again, the Neil Gorsuch hearings start on Monday, March the 20th. And that will be a week from this, a month from this coming Monday. And the opening day will be blah, blah, self-serving statements. And then the questioning starts Tuesday and will go probably most of the week. We'll come back and talk some more with John Lott, the president at the Crime Prevention Research Center, online at crimeresearch.org. And when we do, I would like to talk about something that he has written about banning guns from cops. What? What? Well, we'll have him explain when we come back in a moment. Back to Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO. We've been talking with John Lott. He's president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, their website, crimeresearch.org. You can also follow him on Twitter, at John R. Lott, Jr. That's JohnRLottJr. We talked about the Supreme Court nomination of Neil Gorsuch. Hearings start March 20th. The possibility of maybe another nomination in the near future. Possibly Anthony Kennedy might think about retiring, but that's strictly in the speculative department. We don't know. And there was something else that John had written recently that I thought should be brought up, and that is banning guns from cops is the headline on what you put out here. This is rather bizarre, John, but I'll just read the opening line of your statement here. Places such as the NFL have banned off-duty police from carrying guns at their games. Really?
Yeah. I mean, we've had police officers, off-duty police officers, carrying guns at NFL games from the beginning of the NFL. And, but, you know, there, I guess it's just an example of some of the anti-gun hysteria, in part to move because of pushes by Michael Bloomberg. The NFL has changed its position and banned them. And it's just not an NFL games. There was just a case a week or so ago that I was had written about where the sheriff for Spokane County in Washington on duty, tried to carry his gun with him into an arena for a charity event. And he was banned from being able to go into an arena within his own county.
Now, excuse me, I don't believe that's even remotely legal. There might be some basis on off-duty, but I don't believe that anybody has the power to block someone who is duly authorized to carry a weapon in the line of duty from their particular function. I mean, I couldn't stand in the front of my home and say, you can't bring that gun in here. That's utter baloney. There's no legal basis for that.
You would think, but I think your home is a little bit different than a public facility, and in fact, the board that oversees the arena there banned even the sheriff from Spokane County from being able to carry his gun there. I've confirmed it with him himself, and there are multiple news stories on it.
I don't believe that could ever stand up in court, ever.
Well,
Who
knows what may happen if finally goes to court. All I'm saying is it's an example of how far people are willing to go in terms of their fear about guns. I mean, you know, obviously the sheriff is trusted to go and carry his gun with him anyplace else within the county. But this public facility, this sports arena, he was banned from being able to do it. It's more, I think, of just an indication of kind of the fear that we have about guns than anything that's rational there. But I agree with you. A sheriff who's on duty, you would think eventually if he challenged it in court, would be able to go and carry any place.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that on-duty, off-duty line, that they both are strictly in the category of off-the-wall weirdo, ignorant riffraff, but one of them, I don't know, conceivably, possibly, maybe through some histrionics and gyrations of the law might possibly stand up off duty. On duty, no way in the world. Then let's say that I'm running an illegal gambling joint.
Right.
But it's open to the public. You know, why could I not therefore say no? I'm sorry, you can't bring your gun in here. I mean, what's the difference?
Yeah, no, tell the police that they can't, but on-duty police. Well, I think the difference might be here that this is a public facility, but, again, you know, owned by the government. But, you know, again, I agree with you. I think they would eventually lose that. But the bottom line is it just shows kind of the mindset that people are afraid of having guns. You know, with the off-duty, it makes – absolutely no sense to me. I mean, here are people that we trust on duty to be able to go and carry. These guys, for free, they're going and carrying their guns. If there were to be a terrorist attack or something else were to occur, they would be able to quickly be on the scene there in order to stop something from happening. It's not like people can point to problems that have occurred with off-duty police officers carrying guns at NFL games. You know, in some sense, a lot of this move makes it closer to what much of Europe is. You had France. Police officers in France up until very recently were banned from carrying guns off duty. You may remember the concert, the rock concert attack in November 2015, in which 89 people were killed at that facility. There was actually 8 off-duty police officers, French police officers, who were present at that attack, but all of them were unarmed because they were obeying the French rules at the time that prohibited off-duty police officers from being able to carry. One can only guess how that attack might have turned out differently if even a couple of those officers had been able to have guns with them.
More to come. Back in a moment. Thanks for being with us on the Jim Bohannon Show as we talk with John Lott. Again, he is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, their website, crimeresearch.org. We've talked about the Supreme Court nomination battle and also the move by some jurisdictions to ban police officers from carrying guns off duty and even in some cases on duty. Bizarre. To Linda in Durango, Colorado. Hello, Linda.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're fine, thank you.
Great. Yeah, I agree with the discussion as far as restricting gun, you know, officers from carrying guns, that's looking for nothing but trouble.
Well, of course, if you think we can all just simply hold hands and sing Kumbaya, maybe the terrorists will like us better. I mean, I have no idea what goes through the minds of these people who just are absolutely irrationally fearful of a tool. That's what a gun is. It's a tool.
Exactly. And the fact that if they're banning them from having them in there, then the police can turn around and say, well, we can't come in and rescue you either then, can we?
I would love to see that happen. I'm seriously childish of me, perhaps, but it feels good. I would dearly love to see that happen. Stew in your own juices. Be your own police. Yes, I'm with you. John, your thoughts about this?
Well, I mean, I can't really think of anything to disagree with there. Look, I mean, there's a reason why we have police have guns, and that is, you know...
There are bad people in this world.
Right.
I hope that's not a newsflash for anybody. There are bad people in this world.
You know, even if tomorrow we banned even police having guns, we banned all guns, the notion that somehow we're going to stop terrorists from getting guns. I mean, if you look at the terrorist attacks in France, all the mass public shootings that have occurred in France have all occurred with completely illegal weapons. I mean, you can't even own a semi-automatic gun in France, and yet these attacks occurred with machine guns. They had... In one case, they had a rocket launcher with them. They had grenades. They had TNT. And all the things, that even the handguns that they had.
Don't they know that's illegal?
Yeah, I know. I mean, shoot, we passed the law. That should have made the difference. You know, there was Ron Noble, who was the head of Interpol, kind of Europe's version of the FBI, though they're broader than that. He was head of it for 15 years, and when he went into the job, he was pretty much a strong gun control person, but he said recently one thing that he's learned is that you just if you want to make a safe area, there's two ways to do it. Either one, ban guns, or two, make it so people can defend themselves. But the one thing that he's learned is that it's basically impossible to really create a gun-free zone. If you're talking about soft targets like a movie theater or you know, a restaurant or a mall, he said terrorists are going to find a way of getting weapons into those facilities. And the only thing that you've accomplished then by creating that gun-free zone is making it so that the victims are going to be disarmed, not the killers.
Things to think about. Thank you for your call, Linda. We've got about a minute and a half here, John. Just some concluding thoughts about where we stand in this entire great gun control debate, of which you, of course, have been in the forefront of looking at the issues of the day. Are there big cases or pending legislation or anything of importance that we should know about?
Well, one of the things that happened at the very end of the Obama administration was to pass a Social Security rule that would ban anybody receiving Social Security who is getting help with their finances, having somebody else, let's say, have the power of attorney to handle their finances, from being able to own guns. They claim that if you are mentally incompetent or needed help with your finances, that's indicated you are mentally incompetent on whether to use your gun or how to use your gun in self-defense. The House so far has voted to overturn that regulation. The Senate should be doing that very soon, possibly as soon as the break's over, but the Democrats have been kind of slowing things up with all the confirmations, you know, going through the 30 hours of debate for each cabinet official. But that should be coming soon, and President Trump has already indicated that he would sign that.
Fair enough. All right, well, we're going to pause on that note. Stand by. We'll speak off air. Again, John Lott is our guest. And Dr. Lott is president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Great website, by the way. You learn about a lot of issues there at crimeresearch.org. You can follow John on Twitter at John R. Lott Jr., JohnRLottJr. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One. Hello there. Good evening. Welcome.